Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Okay,
I always
now
forget
we're done for the day. All done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, disclosure. Da-da-da. Let's see. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only an outstanding, riveting, literally, painfully riveting radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory wealth management firm in Salado, Texas, that manages investment portfolios of significant value. And anything we say on here is not investment advice. It is education, and don't act on it.
Well, you can act on it. You can act on the education.
You can act on the education.
Make informed decisions.
Yeah, don't consider it investment advice. We mentioned a security or an investment or something on here. That doesn't mean you should invest in it. It may be totally inappropriate for you. It's kind of like prescription medication. Something that's good for one person may be really, 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 really bad for another person. So anyway,
right.
Now that was a detailed, in plain English, disclosure, I think. What else do we need to say? We don't give tax or legal advice.
No, that's true. We don't do that either.
Talk to Ed if you want legal advice or somebody.
We don't give sports advice.
Boy.
But we are coaches.
Boy, do we not give sports advice.
Not sports advice. Wrong kind of coach.
Yeah, we believe in that life is a sport, and you keep score with dollars. And so our objective is to very slowly move forward in the ground game and win more than we lose. In other words, unlike Babe Ruth, we believe in hitting a lot of singles and doubles, an occasional double, and we get excited when there's a double. But we really don't want to hit home runs. You know, you probably know this because we've said it many, many times. Babe Ruth still does hold the National League.
You're right. He's the record. Strikeout record.
Yeah, he still holds the strikeout record in the National League. So, what else? What happened this week? There was an event at the New York Stock Exchange. Well, actually, I don't know if it's at the New York Stock Exchange. Who owns the Dow Jones Industrial Average now?
It's the Standards and Poor's something or another.
Yeah, but are they owned by – I have to look that up. Anyway, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose through 20,000 this week and stayed there, which is even more impressive. So that in and of itself was quite impressive. We're very, very happy to see the Dow at 20,000. Not because 20,000 is a particular – it's actually 20,093 at the end of the week. Not because 20,000 means anything in a statistical or investment the way we do investment analytical way. It's just a nice – it's really a nice number because I can very well remember when it went through 2,000 – 1987, and because 1987 to 2017, it's a nice round number of years. So, 30 years from, man, that makes me feel old. 30 years from 2000 to 20,000. So, in 30 years, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has multiplied, not counting dividends, by a factor of 10.
Let me read off some of the founding companies in the Dow.
Okay.
Industrial Average,
sure.
Just so that we can see that it doesn't look a lot like it did when it started. So the founding members were American Cotton Oil Company, American Sugar Company, American Tobacco Company. Do these sound industrial to you?
I think somebody was trying to make America great again.
Chicago Gas Company.
Oh, well, Chicago, yeah.
Well, it is gas, and it's sort of industrial.
Right.
Distilling and Cattle Feeding Company. Lackleed Gas Company, another gas company. National Lead Company. North American Company. Well, that's an electric utility, so that had some industrial component there.
Well, there's another – anyway.
Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad, U.S. Leather, and United States Rubber.
That American company that you're talking about? What was it?
North American.
You know, that ultimately became GE, I think.
No, it was broken up by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in 1946.
Oh, okay. Well, GE was in there sometime towards the beginning. Maybe at the very beginning or something. Anyway, of those, the safest one, the one paying, the one that paid the highest dividends at that particular moment, and the one that was considered in the press at the time to be the ideal stock for widows and orphans.
Yes.
U.S. Leather.
Dissolved in 1952.
And left nothing to anybody.
Because those of you that are unaware of this, this is, you know, with those companies, it didn't sound much like industry. It was talking about cotton and sugar and tobacco, gas, leather, lead.
Lead is very industrial.
Rubber. Okay, here's where leather was industrial. Leather was the number one transmission of energy material in the late 1800s going into the early 1900s. The belts that ran all of those big factories were leather. And that is why they were an industrial company. The same is true with cotton and a lot of the other textiles, is that that was the newest concept coming out when you could have a powered loom to create cloth. That was technology. That was industry.
It was also control technology, because the reins on all those horses that were pulling all those wagons.
Transmission of energy and communication.
Right. Was done with leather. And there were a lot of skinned cows to show for it.
Yes. So the end result of that, why did I say that? Because...
You know why you said it?
Yeah, I know why I said it.
Oh, okay.
Because my mouth was opening.
And got it.
Sounds
all
were
right.
coming out. I guess that's how I said it, huh? Mm-hmm. Why I said it is because at any given time, the news organization run indexes, whether it's the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial, any of the commonly quoted or less commonly quoted. Bloomberg's got how many dozen indexes out there now? There's dozens of dozens, I think. So there may be grosses of them. Anyway, the concept is that those indexes can remove companies from the index because they're not actually investing in them. It's just a measurement technique. And I've used this analogy in the past, and it describes some great bubbles that some of our listeners remember and some of our listeners are too young to remember in the early 21st century, 2001. Through 2002, the greatest outflows from the market were coming from indexed funds. And in the late 20th century, the greatest inflows into the market were going into index funds. I have a problem with that. I haven't talked about it on the air for a long time. We can get to the where the market is now. And let me just quick hit this problem. Indexes, by their nature, are a socialist investment vehicle. And that when you put a dollar in, more of that dollar tends to go to the bigger companies in capitally weighted indexed funds, though. So most S&P 500 index positions. It doesn't matter how they're being managed. It doesn't matter who's profitable and who isn't. If they're in the index and they're big enough, they get some of your money. And the bigger they are, the more they get, which sounds pretty Marxist to me. From each according to need, or to merit, or to each according to need. So the bigger you are, the more you get. And when the majority of money going into or out of the market is going into an index-type position, I get a little concerned, because indexes are for measuring things so that we can look around and say, how is the, you know, like a rain gauge is for measuring the amount of rain. You don't have something to catch every drop of rain out there to measure the rain. You have one vial that's catching the rain. And the best analogy I can give for this is the old coffee pots that had the little cylinder with the graduated cylinder on there that showed you how many cups of coffee were in the back tank. You had this little cylinder on the front. And when the majority of money is going into the market through indexes, it's like you're pouring the water into the cylinder instead of into the tank. You don't know what you're measuring if you're distorting the measurement tool by making it part of the thing that it's measuring. It's a little bit weird. It gets me concerned, but I thought I would take a moment and talk about that. So now let's talk about what's happened this week.
Something happened this week?
Yeah, you were mentioning the Dow Jones passed 20,000. That was pretty nice.
Yeah, yeah. The S&P 500 closed out the week at 2294.69, as if
that's
you care.
That's totally not a round number. I don't care about that. I want it only when there are zeros involved.
I got it. The S&P 500 was up 1.03% for the week. It's up 2.5% year-to-date, which is really quite impressive, considering that we've been open for business on the stock market for only less than a month. Less than a month. It's about, and if you, from 1 year ago, it's up 18.27%. You know, kind of the backside to it, and we talk about this in the newsletter, is that had you invested 2 years ago in May, your total gain over the last, from 2015 through 2016 is almost 2 years now, your total gain would have been about 7.7%, which is totally unimpressive. That's about 3.5% a year. And so it's when you invested that makes a big difference. But had you invested in mid-February last year when the market was in the doldrums and we were in the bottom of a recession, the world was about to end because the price of oil was going to collapse through the floor. And I think about that time, Bill Gross said that oil has a lot further to fall. And then immediately, of course, oil started back up again, and so did the market. But you would have had like a 25% gain. I mean, if you could have invested in the S&P 500, the S&P 500 is up 25%. So that's the kind of news in the market. It's continuing to rise. What caused it to rise this week? Well, in the middle of the week, we got some bad news about housing, that the existing home sales were down.
Bad news, good news.
Interest rates are up. Mortgage rates are up. But last year was a really good year for house sales.
Right. So that's why I say bad news, good news. December wasn't all that great, but for the year, the whole year was pretty fantastic for house sales. So
I think everybody pretty much knew what had happened during the year.
Right.
The analysis I saw, and it was coincident with a lot of things, is that the market jumped above 20,000 when it became pretty clear that a couple of things are still percolating along and headed in the right direction. One is a very significant reduction in corporate taxes and federal regulatory burden, as it's called. Those are big things. The other one was that apparently, although nobody's figured out how to pay for it yet, the idea of dropping $1 trillion into infrastructure in the United States is still moving forward. So you got a couple of things going on out there that are pretty significant. One, by reducing corporate taxes to 20%, and there seems to be the corporate tax rate, maximum rate in the United States today is 35. By reducing it to 20, that is a tremendous savings for corporations in the United States. It also means they can bring some money home and invest it here, which previously the tax situation kept them from doing. And the second thing that's in there is the regulatory burden has indeed gotten pretty restrictive over the last several years.
Very much so.
And those two things being lifted causes the guys who count beans on Wall Street
to go, hey, things got a little bit less complicated here.
We'll maybe have some more profits
maybe
next year.
So the regulatory environment, this is a good one to talk about here. One of the many executive orders that was signed this last week was freezing new regulations without having White House review and approval first. So there's a lot of rules that are being made right now that aren't final yet. There are rules that have a final version out, but it isn't to the deadline when the final version becomes the actual rule. So there's a freeze across the board on that. And one of those freezes is the fiduciary rule. We've talked about that for a while. That is maybe a little bit of the baby in the bathwater. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot of regulations that are out there that are way over the top. Way over the top. The concept that there are reams of paper, and this is a literal thing. I have about 2/3 of a ream of paper sitting on my desk at the office on a new methodology for filing with the SEC, which is an annual thing that we do. And when I dug through it, none of the new things affect what we do. But what we do has been rearranged completely so that it's taking tens of hours just to figure out how to file the paperwork, which is an annual thing, and to make sure that all of the data is together is more tens of hours when you're talking about weeks of time to do a minor regulatory function. That's a problem. And when the president says we've got to fix this problem, I agree with that. He's fixing a problem without nuances, which is the negative side, but he's doing something, which is a positive side. He's knocking down a whole bunch of things all at once and saying, all right, what should we pick back up? And I'm concerned that some of the good things might not get picked back up, but so are a lot of people.
Well, there's also another thing, and this is something, again, we warned about in the newsletter this week, but I think if you're an investor, this is important to get a hold of. The market has risen at least 10%, depending on how you look at it, and different areas in the market have risen more or less based on rhetoric, pure rhetoric. And rhetoric is talking but not doing.
Right.
There are some very, very, very significant problems on how to accomplish all of this that simply have not been addressed. Somebody has got to – Congress has got to pass – a series of laws, one of which, by the way, to make this fly in any way that I can imagine.
Which this?
This the
regulatory?
Well, not just the regulatory issues. The abolishment of Obamacare.
Yep.
The $1 trillion, and I don't know where they got that number, but that's the president's pledge. $1 trillion spent on infrastructure and the wall. All are probably going to require – they require one of several things, or maybe a combination. We either cut some very popular programs like defense or Social Security, which I don't think is going to happen, particularly in light of the fact the president just indicated he wants to spend more on defense.
Right.
And he said he wouldn't touch Social Security.
I see three possibilities.
Okay. The second thing that they could do is raise taxes somewhere, and admittedly the 20% import tax – the 20% corporate tax on imports might work. On the other hand, there's some complications that could backfire on that thing really big. Like if you go to the grocery store this time of year and you look at the produce in the grocery store, you'll discover it's almost all from outside the United States because it's pretty cold in the United States, and we simply don't produce enough food in the wintertime, fresh food, to feed ourselves. So if you can imagine all of that food going up by 20%,
yeah.
Price of gasoline going up by about 10%. All your electronics going up 20%. Cars going up 10 to 15% in price.
Let's come at this from a slightly different direction.
Okay.
Totally in agreement with what you're saying. But I'm going to do it in a direction that from the other viewpoint, when Obama was doing similar things.
Well, let me get to the end of this, then we can come back to the middle, okay?
Okay.
The end is – the market has risen a lot on promises, and so far nobody has come up with a plan that seems to work to pay for all those promises.
Right.
And if they don't do things like repeal the Balanced Budget Act
– that's the third option.
And borrow a lot of money.
You either cut taxes – raise taxes, cut spending, or you repeal the Balanced Budget Act. That's what Congress has to do to figure out how to pay for this stuff.
I'm looking for somebody to wave a magic wand or a magic mouse or something and find a way to do that. But here's the point. The market is up on expectations that are all positive, which means it could come down just as quickly as it went up. So just buckle your seatbelts and hang on.
So when we're talking about using a border tax, a tariff, to pay for a wall or anything else for that matter, if we're going to lower corporate tax rates, if we want to increase our revenue through something else, putting a tariff
up. It's not really a tariff if you just tax the corporations.
It's still a tariff. It falls under every definition of tariff that you want to look up. it's just a targeted tariff rather than a tariff on everyone.
It's, you know, the corporations.
Yeah, it's like saying it's not really
deduct the cost of anything they import.
It's kind of like saying Texas doesn't have an income tax. Well, that's not true because the franchise tax is definitely an income tax. It's just not on everyone.
Yeah.
So the tariff concept, this is very much like what I have talked about the Consumer Protection Bureau. They have levied some fees against big scam artists. Huge fees. They've levied fees against Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo is an easy one to talk about. Hundreds of millions of dollars from Wells Fargo. Well, where did the money go? Did it go to the people that were damaged by the extra accounts being opened in their name? No. It went to the Consumer Protection Bureau. That means that that money is just going into government coffers, and we're feeling very good about it because we're punishing bad guys or somebody that's messed up, but it didn't help the person that was hurt. And when we're talking about a tariff for imports, that money does go directly to the government, and it's a change from doing it in the corporate tax area, but the prices will immediately change, where the corporate tax rate has to wait till tax filing season to change. For us, if the corporate tax rate is cut, we're going to need to see some time to watch the prices drop.
Mm-hmm.
If the tariff gets put in, the tariff comes in immediately. So if you're buying something and there's a tariff on it, the price goes up by that tariff as soon as you go to buy it.
My understanding of what's going on in the House is they want to enact the cut in corporate tax rate and the prohibition against deducting the expenses of imports and giving tax-free the profits on exports all in one bill. So
that's going to be a complicated bill.
It will be a well, yes,
and
tax
all
bills.
All it takes is just a few senators. Senator McCain is not real happy with the president. Rand Paul is not real happy with the president.
Well, now
Marco Rubio is not real happy with the president.
Anyway you approach this, the government, and that's one of the big points here, is the government from that tax change alone. Now, we're not talking about all the other things that they're talking about doing. From that tax change, the government will get, every economist agrees, much more revenue. But whose pocket will the revenue come out of? And the answer is the pocket that it will come out of, as it appears in every way we approach it today, is yours, because the things you buy will rise in price and the government will get more money.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to a value-added tax, except it's applied to imports and exports.
Right.
And whether that, once it sinks in, that there will be a lot of jobs suddenly disappear when that happens that are dependent upon imported goods that no longer will, when the goods no longer make sense to import. And prices will rise all over the United States for pretty much everything we buy. Will that go through Congress? I don't know. This is one of the things where the House of Representatives will have to face the results 2 years from now. And if prices have jumped a whole bunch and jobs have been lost 2 years from now because of this system, they would pay for it, and they're fully aware of that. So I think they might. So the whole point is, the president has got some really good ideas, deregulation, in our opinion, being the first in line. Cutting corporate taxes is a great idea, but somewhere we have to make up the revenue. And the idea, of course, is to make up the revenue by taxing effectively, I wouldn't say taxing imports, not allowing deductions for imports.
Right. And let's come up at this again from a different direction. Let's look at this in history. There has never been a point in American history where taxing imports has created jobs. The opposite happens.
Yeah,
and this is not theory anymore. This is well-defined historic fact, but we keep doing it. And
it
it's
feels
happened.
Good.
It feels good. It really does feel good. It's kind of like a union action where nobody's allowed to work except us and we're going to charge more. That is what import tariffs are, is, you know, if if somebody, you know, Texas is a right-to-work state. You don't have to be a member of the union. There are states in the United States that if you go to work at a job and you say, I'm going to be competitive, I'm going to come in here and get this job, and it's not as much as they're paying the other guy to do the same job, but I'm going to get the job because I need a job. There are states where that's not legal because you got to be part of the union and you got to get that upper pay, even if it means that the company can't afford to hire you. That's what happens when we put import tariffs, because an import tariff is our choice. The problem with it is that it doesn't sit in a vacuum. You put an import tariff on Mexico, and Mexico puts an import tariff on us. So if you're Ford or General Motors, it does make it more expensive to make parts overseas. It makes it more expensive to make parts in Mexico and bring them back. But that means that they got to go back to the right to work states. And that might be nice. Maybe they'll set up some plants in Texas, because if they go to the majority of places that their historic plants have been, they can't try to be competitive on pay because the unions get involved. And that means that the prices of American cars go up, which means that even if we're putting an import tax on other cars coming in from other countries, the taxes on all cars, or the prices of all cars, will rise at that point, because the labor in the United States to get things done is higher, likely, or similar to the import tax. So it doesn't work for creating jobs. It's never worked for creating jobs. You might get jobs made, but on aggregate, you lose jobs.
Matter of fact, Gene Epstein wrote a very interesting article that apparently the folks at General Motors and Ford and all that have already started crunching the numbers for this new tax regime.
Right.
And they have come to an interesting conclusion. It would be prohibitively expensive to import all the parts that they import, that they put into the cars today, and then manufacture them in the United States. And they basically have two choices: manufacture the entire car outside the United States, which probably wouldn't work. But the big thing is build new plants in the United States, which would immediately kick in a lot of construction jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But the plants would be almost entirely robotic.
Right.
Because they looked at the cost. There's two issues. Number one, the cost of hiring and training people to operate, to do the work that's currently being done, for example, in Mexico. And secondly, what they'd have to pay those people, because we're pretty much out of unemployed skilled workers.
Yeah,
which means that they've already calculated in and concluded that they could build assembly plants that were run by robots cheaper than hiring people.
You mentioned that Ford and General Motors are already starting to look to see how the numbers are going to work out. One of the first actions that Ford has done is they're pulling out of Japan. They're not manufacturing cars in Japan to send to the United States. They're manufacturing cars in the United States and some of the parts in Japan to sell in Japan. Japan over the years has had some great tariffs, big, big, big tariffs on all imports, exports. They don't have tariffs on car imports or exports anymore. Just don't have it. Mm-hmm. We have worked with them over the years to say, hey, let's have a level playing field. Let's agree on what we do here so that our cars can go into your country, your cars can come into our country, and we can compete on a level concept of our cars can be better, and that would be why someone would buy them, or your cars would be better, and that would be why someone would buy them. American cars don't do well in Japan, not because of tariffs, not because of taxes, but because they don't do well in Japan. That's not the same with German cars. German cars do great in Japan. Lots of people buy BMWs there. There are not very many Escalades on the road in Tokyo.
The streets are too narrow.
Right. So the concept...
And the steering wheel's on the wrong side.
The concept is that Ford is profitable there now. But as soon as we start putting tariffs on countries that have a deficit, a trade deficit. We have a trade deficit with them. So Japan is one of those. Japan exports far more than it imports and has for many, many years. If we put a tariff on Japan, which fits every criteria that the president has given for tariffs, is that if we've got a trade deficit with your country, we're going to put a tariff on you, then they're going to do the same thing to us over there. And Ford's just saying, we're going to leave. It's not worth competing because we're about to have our hands tied here, because we're about to try to tie their hands over there. The thing is that Toyota, for instance, makes most of the cars that it sells in the United States in the United States, which means that Ford is no longer able to compete overseas, but Toyota is still able to compete here because it's going to be manufactured here. That's not the intent, but that's where unintended consequences come in very quickly when we make broad sweeping decisions. Trade is a very sensitive area. So now we're covering two areas in about the same depth right now, regulation and trade. The regulatory environment needs fixing, and it's being worked on, and hopefully this comes out with something good, but we don't know what the end result is going to be. Trade is actually doing pretty great. It doesn't need a whole lot of fixing, but there's a perception that it does. And now we have to wait and see what happens there.
Well, you know, I read a very good article about NAFTA. And it turns out that the overall contribution of NAFTA to the economy is maybe 1 or 2/10 of 1% to our GDP. Now, when you have a GDP report of 1.9%, that means it would be 1.7%. But what it's done, and this is certainly in agreement with what the perception is, it's done a lot more good for Mexico than it has for the United States. But the end result is the gang wars, the mass murders in Mexico have started to filter out. And here's a crucial point. There's a lot more Mexicans returning to Mexico, illegal aliens, than are coming over the border to the United States now, largely because there's a lot of good employment in Mexico.
I have to call you on something.
Okay.
It looks like, from if you look at the numbers, as a percentage of GDP, there's a bigger percentage that Mexico's getting out of NAFTA. There's a bigger percentage that Canada's getting out of NAFTA as a percentage of their GDP. Look at the numbers again in absolute dollars, in actual profit dollars. America makes a lot more money off of NAFTA than Mexico or Canada does. Huge amounts of money more. It's just a smaller percentage of our GDP because our GDP is a lot bigger than Canada's and Mexico's. The reason why I can tell you that, very simply, is because the manufacturing happening in Mexico are contract manufacturers. They're not reaping the profits of the parts that they're creating. They are, in many cases, not even contract manufacturers. There are manufacturing facilities 100% owned by American companies. So the profit of the American company is a lot more than what they're paying to the workers at the plant. That's the concept, that when you look at percentages, things get weird when you're talking about GDP. America is by far the largest benefactor of NAFTA. However, as a percentage of what we do, it's a pretty small thing because we're just a lot bigger as far as economies go.
Yeah, basically, if you look at the trade balance between the United States and Mexico in 1993, we had a $1.7 billion trade surplus with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, we had a $61 million trade deficit with Mexico. But
right.
When we get down to the nitty-gritty, by the way, those trade surpluses and deficits,
particularly
with Mexico, are subject to, when you look at the details on it, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
Because a lot of that is we're sending raw materials to Mexico. Mexico is turning them into car parts and sending them back. Well, the car part is worth more than the raw material.
Right. This is something that was put together under Wilson as far as how we track how imports and exports are valued. So let's use Ford for an example, or anybody else, but Ford's a good one. We're already talking about them. Ford sends money or raw materials, iron, to a plant in Mexico. That iron is valued at a very tiny amount of money. Very tiny being relative because it's a big corporation. That tiny amount of iron value becomes car parts. Car parts come back. Mexico was not paid for the value of the car part. Mexico had hourly workers paid and a plant built. Those parts come back. Those parts are valued at the wholesale value of the part. Now, no financial transaction took place of buying and selling those parts. Those parts were manufactured by an American company for sale in America. And it looks like we have a horrible imbalance of trade. That's kind of like during the Great Recession, Texas was a huge exporter of tax dollars to the rest of the country.
Yeah, if you actually...
But now we're a huge importer of tax dollars. We're making more in Texas today off of tax dollars than we're spending in tax dollars on the federal level.
To make this simple about what's going on with NAFTA is not to look at the $60 billion trade deficit. By the way, I have broken that thing down, and it's not really a trade deficit. It's an interesting concept, but let's simply say the biggest portion of that is American plant investment, building factories in Mexico.
That's right.
It isn't true trade. It's just building the factory over there,
which is owned by the American company.
Right, which is owned by the American company, which it becomes really weird. Why is that an export? Anyway, but if we take Caterpillar, one of the biggest construction, certainly one of the biggest vehicle heavy equipment. I mean, you're talking about manufacturing and construction, Caterpillar's it. So they last year exported $33 million more in products to Mexico than it imported from Mexico. And that's pretty typical. If you actually get rid of all this, the raw material goes to Mexico and then it comes back as a car part that's assembled in Detroit or assembled in an American assembly factory somewhere in the United States, and then it's either sold to Americans or exported somewhere else. If you get rid of the very intense complexity of this, and you boil down to the fact that Caterpillar makes stuff in the United States and exports it to Mexico, and it has a $33 million trade surplus with Mexico last year, and if we start a trade war with Mexico, the Japanese heavy equipment companies will probably rather, or the Chinese heavy equipment companies will very quickly pick up that $33 million in profit as Mexico imports from China and Japan rather than buying from Caterpillar.
There's a really simple premise here. The very simple thing to underline. If we cannot compete, changing the rules so that other people take a handicap in the sport or the trade is a good way to make people give us handicaps too, because we lead the world in trade. We lead the world in GDP. We lead the world in quality in many, many, many areas. Your phone is talking to you. We lead the world in all of these areas, and if we start penalizing the world for trying to compete with us, they're going to penalize us back. We don't do this in a vacuum, and this happened in the early 20th century, and it happened, unfortunately, right in the middle of what was a recession and became the Great Depression, that we said, all right, we're going to protect jobs. And that is by far the biggest single contributor to the unemployment rate that followed and the spiraling down into further depression in our economy. So the president has some really good ideas, and the president has some ideas that feel good as well.
Well, there's another.
The feel good ones are the ones that are the dangerous ones.
But there's a reality in NAFTA that there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that details it very well. There was a concentration of economic loss in certain states and in certain areas.
That's right.
Where a lot of heavy manufacturing or light manufacturing, like Oreo cookies, moved to Mexico. And if you're in a town that is a one-factory town, and there are a lot of small one-factory towns across the South, and the owner of that factory shuts it down and starts producing Oreo cookies or whatever in Mexico, the impact on that town is immense.
Yes, it's devastating.
And I think this is just my opinion. This is Jeff speaking. This is just my opinion at this point, which with $1.50, you can get a cup of coffee in some restaurant.
Not at Starbucks.
Some restaurants. And the issue is really simple. Had there been some event that caused a massive displacement of working opportunities, and I'm going to get in a sensitive area here, for some identifiable minority in the United States where there were bills in place and court decisions in place to assist them, there would have been federal money flow in to retrain, to do whatever needed to be done to fix that situation. And I think it's a reaction at this point, and maybe a justifiable reaction, that there was, I think, an assumption that a white middle-class male worker, if he's out of a job, he can always find a job someplace else. And I realize that that's politically non-correct, what I just said. I realize that there is racial discrimination in the United States. I realize we have a lot of problems. But when we don't apply economics to this rather than politics, when we don't look out there and say, we've just devastated, NAFTA just devastated this little town in Georgia, what are we going to do about it?
Right. And it was a government decision to do it. The government... While I am fully, fully supportive of self-entitlement and the ability to create your own destiny, if the government steps in and messes up your destiny, they should give you a little hand up to say, hey, why don't you – we're going to help you move to a town that has some other factories that you can go and use your skills for, because we basically just took your job.
They should have, in my humble opinion – provided the equivalent of the GI Bill.
Wait a minute. Your humble opinion?
Yeah.
I want to hear an humble opinion. I haven't heard one yet.
I am not smart enough to know all the answers, but it seems to me to be rational to say that if we did something that's good for the broad United States economy, and it was, and raised tax revenue for the government, which it did, and in the process we devastate a little town in Georgia. If it had been a flood or a tornado that devastated that town, the federal government would have stepped in with assistance. But since it was NAFTA that devastated that town, the federal government did nothing.
Right. We've got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us on the air, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we only got about 7 minutes left in the time, so we're going to talk really, really fast. And you can give us a call at 773-1400, area code 254-773-1400.
I don't think we're going to talk like that.
Why?
I don't like it.
You don't like it?
Nope, don't like it.
Well, now, that's regional bias.
It is. If we were in New York, that would be the norm, and I don't like it. Nope.
You don't? I don't like it either, so I think we ought to maybe talk like this.
In the words of Ren and Stimpy, no, sir, I don't like it.
Oh, okay. Did they originate those words?
Mm. I don't know if they originated. I don't think they came up with the words individually, but I was quoting them when I said it.
Well, 5 minutes left in the program for the first hour.
I've got something I wanted to bring up.
Okay,
here.
Bring it
it's
up.
A good one.
Because I got something I want to save for next hour.
Do you want to save for next hour or save for next hour?
Both.
Both. Okay. I wanted to talk about the rig count. Rigs. The oil rigs, gas rig count. Gas rigs, last a week and a half ago, the report came out. They were up 29 rigs. Well, that's no big deal. How many rigs do we have out there? Well, a lot, but not as much as you would think. So there are 551 rigs out there. And before that, there were 29 less. So we're back up to where we were in around April of 2013 as far as rig counts go. So active gas rigs rose by 6. This, if I'm looking at the oil rig chart, we had a little drop, but the construction on those rigs is picking up speed rather rapidly. And this has zero to do with the president. This has everything to do with OPEC limiting the amount of oil that it's exporting. So the price of oil has come back up into the mid-50s, the low to mid-50s, which is eminently profitable for a lot of the fracking projects that are out there, and natural gas becomes extremely profitable at those same rates. So that's a statement that we should not expect huge jumps in oil prices going into the future. We've got too much oil and gas sitting under our feet, just waiting for us to turn the pumps back on for the price to go up very much, even if OPEC thinks that they can lower their output and cause the price to go up. So that's a really great concept of when a bunch of countries get together and say, we're not going to put out as much of something because that will limit the supply and therefore the demand isn't going down. So the price is going to go up. Well, if they're not the only people with the supply, people go to other sources for their oil, and this is just trade. So when there is an arbitrary, either governmental or group of companies or countries getting together to say, we're going to raise the price, when there's other product available, people will go to the other product. And that kind of ties in oil with trade, as we were talking about. A tariff on imports causes other countries to either stop exporting to us so that we're importing from them, or the prices go up. And maybe that will allow us to buy things in the United States at an equal footing if we're buying the same product that an American made, it'll be at the same price. But that's going to be rare because a lot of those American products don't have all American parts inside them. So keep that in mind. There's two places. One, easy to see. We've got a lot of oil. They try to raise prices overseas. We just make more oil here. Put a tariff on things, make things more expensive. We're going to find another way of doing this, even if it means that organizations leave the United States. And that's a sad thing.
You think we need organizations to leave the United States?
No, I think that in many cases, if there are tariffs on American companies that are doing business overseas, what will happen is that the American company will do a spinoff. And that American company will no longer be 100% American company. They'll have an Irish company. They'll have a Pakistani country,
right,
or a company, or a Mexican company that doesn't have the same restrictions in bringing. That's the point that is true in oil or any other trade. If you have an artificial barrier to trade, just like water, you find the next way around it. And if that means that American companies or foreign companies split things, we're still talking about the same dollar. But now it's more complicated to get that dollar out.
Well, we got a lot more to talk about this and about some other things, including the GDP report that just came out that looks on the surface like it dropped a whole bunch, but really didn't. And from the third quarter to the fourth quarter. But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're going to do a break for Fox News here in just a minute, literally less than a minute. But if you'd like to contact us off the air, we are a wealth management firm, fee only, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And we do investment and portfolio management and advice for generally families with higher net worth. You can give us a call at locally 254-947-1111, or
you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts, read our philosophy, read our newsletters. And until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.